Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 6 minutes after 9 a.m., March 14th, 2012. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, Senator McGuire. Senator Pascavan has joined us, and there may be other senators that join us, and Senator Giesel's here. There'll be other senators that come and go as this process unfolds. Today, we're starting our second hearing on Senate Bill 192, the oil and gas production tax. Today we're going to hear a presentation from the Department of Revenue. We have with us today the Commissioner Brian Butcher and some of his deputies, and he could bring them forward as he needs them or wants them to share in his presentation. What we have today is a presentation from the Department of Revenue dealing with Senate Bill 192. This is the first time they've had the opportunity to come forward and speak on this bill. This is kind of an introductory presentation. We'll be going into substantially more detail in the coming weeks. So we haven't had the opportunity here to look through the presentation, so we'll be seeing it for the first time as we roll through it. But if there's areas in here that need to be explored in further detail, we have ample time over the next few weeks to do that. So we don't want the committee members to think that this is the only time the department will be here. They'll be here numerous times. And with that, I'd like to go ahead and invite the commissioner to come forward, please. And he can introduce himself for the record. And I see he's already flanked by his trusty aides.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Butcher, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. With me is Tax Division Deputy Commissioner Bruce Tangeman, as well as our Acting Assistant Chief Economist Dan Stickle. I believe we have a few folks online, but this is a fairly concise, high-level presentation, so we're certainly available to get into details as the committee likes. We should have the folks to do that. We've been asked to give the department's position on individual components of the bill, as well as kind of a high-level suggested improvements to pieces of the bill. And then we have a couple of slides comparing current law to SB 192 as well as the governor's bill. And the reason for doing that is a lot of times discussion revolves around what's a material change that will increase the investment climate in the state. And the governor has made it clear that he believes his bill does that, but it's not the only way to get to that point. It can be done in different ways. And so we'll just kind of lay out where we see that trigger point and how we get to that trigger point is something that we can certainly discuss. Overview of what's in CS for SB 192, and we won't spend a lot of time on that on this since the committee heard from Senator Pasvan in detail about it yesterday, so we don't have to dig into the details. It's been explained, but we'll be going over the progressive surcharge, allowance for production increases, gross minimum tax, the petroleum information system, and the decoupling issued briefly. Touching on the change in the bill to progressivity, it changes the progressivity over $30 a barrel, the production tax value from 0.4 per dollar to 0.35. Changes the trigger point that slows the rate of progressivity from $92.50 to, in current law, to $101.43 production tax value. And the maximum production tax rate would change from 75% to 60%, and that would apply at a little over $200 a barrel in production tax value, which would be approximately $240 a barrel price.
And if you could just stop there, and I'll be stopping you probably from time to time, just to have you define some terms, because we are all so used to using these terms and throwing them around the table so the public can easily follow, or if there's some new members of the public that aren't as familiar. One of them is this PTV thing. Could you tell them? Explain to us what that is.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Production tax value is the value of a barrel of oil that the tax is applied to after subtracting out operating expenses, capital expenses, and transportation of that barrel. So basically coming up with a number for what the cost is to produce the barrel and transport the barrel, and then looking at the profit number above that and applying the tax to that as opposed to the cost of the entire barrel of oil.
So what's the basically the net profit, gross net profit, or sometimes it may be referred to at the table as profit oil?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, okay.
Based on our department's fall 2011 forecast, this piece of the bill would reduce revenue by an estimated $125 million in FY13, $230 million in FY14, and approximately $200 million a year from FY15 through FY21.
And maybe, again, just for clarity, could you give the public kind of an idea what we're talking about? And when we talk about a reduction of $200 million, but can you talk a little bit about, or just basically mention, what is the thing worth per year? What are we talking about in dollars?
Mr. Chairman, so asking kind of what the larger number is that we would be reducing by $200 million?
Yeah, just generally, just so people have an idea. Of
$6 billion, more or less in that area. And so we'd be looking, and as we go through this, as an example on slide 5, it gives you an idea of looking. And the black line is current law. And this is the effective production tax rate, effective being what the actual tax rate is that a company would pay under this. And the black line is current law. The red line is SB 192. So as you can see, under the current price of oil, which is approximately $120 a barrel, you see a small reduction in what the companies would pay, and then you see it being slightly lower as the price of oil goes up to about $240 a barrel, which I had just mentioned was when the new cap of 60% rather than 75% would apply, and then at that point, over $240 a barrel, you would see a larger difference.
Okay, and
we'll also discuss the minimum floor that's been put in other slides and how that'll affect it on the lower price of oil.
Okay, and I see you have your disclaimer. I just want to make sure that as we go through these things, we're all thinking about and talking about the same thing. Here you're using the FY12 numbers out of this revenue source book, and the CapEx number at $10.25, can you maybe highlight that, why that number is $10 and not a higher numeric, and then in total dollar terms what that would be to make sure we're all looking at digesting the same information?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Mr. Stickle to respond to that.
Sure. Dan Stickle, Acting Assistant Chief Economist for the Department of Revenue. The $10.25 capital expenditures represents the deductible capital expenditures by those companies that have a tax liability per barrel of taxable oil. And that number comes from Appendix D of the Revenue Sources Book, where the total capital expenditures that are deductible in FY12 is approximately $1.8 billion. And so what we're doing there is we're dividing that $1.8 billion by the taxable barrels of about 176 million barrels to come up with the $10.25.
So I guess to craft it in what you told me in another verbiage, it would be the not the homogenized rate of what we'd see collectively across our oil basin, but the average rate of the last of the three major producers, Exxon, Mobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, that actually generate revenue and have substantial oil sales down their pipelines. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, it would be the the average per barrel of those companies that have a tax liability and are able to deduct their capital expenditures.
Right, but those are the only three that I'm aware of that have anything of any significance. Is there some other one?
Mr. Chairman, without getting into specifics of which companies are paying tax and which companies are not paying tax, there are multiple companies that have a tax liability in any given year.
Okay. So then let me put it another way. What fields are we talking about? Are we talking about Prudhoe Bay?
Mr. Chairman, it is a company-specific tax, so it relates to the company's operations across multiple fields. We do see that the majority of the tax revenue is coming from Prudhoe, Kaparik, and Alpine. But for those companies that have a tax liability, they'd also have, if they have operations in other fields, those capital expenditures would also be deductible by those companies since the tax is company-specific.
As an example, you can take Exxon Mobil will have substantial expenditures in the field on the – mine just went blank on the one they're working on that's in litigation.
Point Thompson.
There's several hundred million in expenditures and credits coming into the Treasury the last few years from Point Thompson. So Point Thompson would be included in this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. If a company were to have existing production in the major fields and have a tax liability for that, and then that same company were to make an investment in a new field, such as a Point Thompson, those costs would be deductible.
Okay. And then if we were to use these numbers and we were just, and I don't know, I haven't looked down, but just if we use the total numbers within our oil basin, would we see these, which would be everybody, the net effect, the net to the Treasury of all participants, large and small, would these tax percentages increase or decrease? And if so, by roughly how much?
Mr. Chairman, if you were to use averages for all companies, including those that are not able to deduct their expenditures, you'd basically see this curve shift out to the right. So the average price that you'd reach a certain tax level would be a little bit higher. I don't have the exact difference with me, but you would see the curve shift to the right a little bit. But the general trend between the two tax systems would remain the same.
Well, let me, and the curve, I'm a little confused. The curve shouldn't shift to the right. It should shift down or up on the percent of the tax on the y-axis, shouldn't it?
Right, Mr. Chairman. That would be another way to look at it. The point I was trying to make is that we're displaying the effective tax rates here in West Coast price per barrel. In terms of displaying the graphs on a production tax value basis, those numbers would remain the same. So it's what is the difference between production tax value and ANS West Coast price that you use to generate the specific chart, and you just have if you use the costs for all companies, you'd have a bigger delta between your production tax value and your West Coast.
Okay, well, maybe we'll go on, but maybe get back to the committee on kind of what that is, and the reason the it may seem a little laborious for some people, the point of discussion here is the major producers dealing with Prudhoe and Kaparik, with Prudhoe doing about 300,000 barrels a day and Kaparik roughly 160 or whatever it is. I think Prudhoe's a little higher the last couple of days, and I think between the two of them there were about 500 total barrels a day of production. That's the area that the committee's going to be concentrating on the next several weeks. But we need to also be able to benchmark the overall aggregate effect, because a lot of times that's all the numbers we get to look at here. But we need to recognize that is not the tax burden that the major fields are under. And we need to be able to parse that out, which is what you're trying to do here. So I'm just trying to explain to the public why there's an interest and the difference between, and why we need to be clear what we're talking about. If we're talking about our major producing fields, which will be our point most of the time in the discussion, and then these smaller explorers, which basically aren't in production mode. Okay. So I'm not trying to get picky, I'm just trying to set the stage so we all understand what we're talking about. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then I just wanted to clarify, the title of the slide is Effective Production Tax Rate, ACES and Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 192, Progressivity Only, so I'm assuming you're not including the base tax.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, yes, this is just showing the progressivity piece of a comparison between current law and SB 192.
Thank you.
And to
wait, I think better define effective tax. So I don't want him to, I don't want the committee members to misinterpret what was just said. You want to define what is the components of that tax, please?
Right. So what we're doing for this slide, and there's several slides throughout the presentation where we look at effective production tax rates, is we take the total production tax paid, including the base tax and the progressivity tax, less capital credits, and it looks at the ratio between that net production tax received to the total production tax value to get the effective tax rate for production tax after credits. And if I could, what we've done in this presentation is we've analyzed each of the components of the bill separately. So this looks at the one component of the bill, which is the change in progressivity, and the other components are modeled in separate slides in the presentation.
I just didn't want people to think it was just a progressivity issue in this slide. This is base tax plus progressivity, less credits, but it doesn't isolate other components within the bill.
Right. That is correct, Mr. Chairman. I guess you're right. There are two pieces of it, the effective tax piece of it, and then the piece of it that focuses specifically on this section of the bill.
Okay. And then, again, I haven't had a chance to, you know, go through your presentations, so some of these questions may be answered later. There's been a lot of discussion, and there will be in the going forward, too, on this issue of marginal rate. Why isn't the tax rate shown here at 90%? Which is the marginal rate, peak marginal rate. If you can just kind of give us, and we can get into that in more detail later, but for the public that always hears that they pay a 90% rate, why aren't you showing a 90% rate? Is another way of couching the question.
Mr. Chairman, there's a few different ways that you can look at tax rates for comparison between different systems like this. What the effective tax rate looks at is the total tax paid by the companies divided by the total tax base, which is the production tax value. The other way of looking at it is the marginal tax rate, where you look at what is the tax paid on an additional dollar of value compared to that dollar of value. And under the ACES system, when you get into current prices and higher prices, the tax paid on that additional dollar of value, say if the price of oil went up from $100 to $101, that is the tax that approaches the 80 and 90% level of marginal tax. And I believe we have a marginal slide later on in the presentation. We can get into that more.
Okay. And then just, again, because we're getting into this, just setting the groundwork, you've got a slide here that shows ANS West Coast oil prices from 60 to 300. My understanding is you're freezing capital and operating expenditures, sliding your oil price. So give us a little soundbite on why it's presented that way for clarity, and if this was actually to happen, why it probably wouldn't look like this in reality.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The intent of this particular slide is to present a snapshot of 1 year, and for the purposes here, we use our fiscal year 12 costs, and it presents a snapshot. If a company has made their capital and their operating commitments and the price were to change from one level to another over the short term, we wouldn't expect a huge change in costs. Now, if you were to see a move to $60 or $300 over a long term of multiple years, then you would expect the cost of doing business would change accordingly. But for purposes of this presentation, you're correct. We have just frozen the lease expenditures to provide a snapshot.
And we'll go on here to the next slide, but I think as we go forward, too, there will be a request that we bring in the x-axis down to some other level. Maybe it's 180, maybe it's 160 or 200 or sometime when we zero in on kind of the more normal range that we would expect it to bounce around in, recognizing that there is some value in looking way out to 300, but our operating and capital expenditures would, as you mentioned, look totally different in a world of $250, $300 barrel oil than they do today at $100 barrel oil.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. There would be, as Mr. Stickle said, there would be a lag, but it would eventually increase.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Go ahead and continue.
To summarize a little bit on this progressive surcharge piece, the department doesn't believe that these changes will do enough to provide meaningful change that would influence investment decisions by companies. The biggest benefit from this would come at very high prices, in excess of $240 a barrel from the current law. And we appreciate the reduction in cap from 75% to 60%, but we'd like it considered a potential cap of 50%, and it's something we'll touch on in a little bit more detail in a little while, as well as a bracketed approach, and that's also something we're going to discuss a little later in the presentation. Or further reductions in progressivity slope is also a change that can be made to change the percentage take between government and companies. This also just touches briefly on increasing the complexity for the department as well as for taxpayers. And in having conversations with a lot of different jurisdictions as well as a lot of different companies over the last year, if there's one issue that seemed to be discussed in almost every situation, it was how complicated Alaska's tax structure is compared to virtually any other jurisdiction, and how detrimental that ultimately is. And with not just the way progressivity works, but also with the number of tax credits we have, and Pedro Van Meers did a pretty good job of discussing when he was in front of the committee conversations he had had with Repsol, who had come in last year and purchased into the oil patch on the North Slope, and how many people they had focused on trying to understand Alaska's tax structure, and how they still weren't entirely sure they understood it. And in fact, they've been going back and forth with the department for quite a few months now, trying to nail down exactly how to define Alaska's tax regime. And obviously, if you're a company and you can't do a definitive job explaining to your board of directors what exactly will occur in different pieces of your economic model to them, you're going to have a hard time getting companies to invest. So if we are looking at pieces that are going to make the tax system in Alaska more complex, it's got to be something that gives more benefit than it does detriment. And certainly at this point, the more complicated it gets, the more difficult it is. As an example, when we visited the state of North Dakota, they have one person that does their oil taxes in the department. And I'm not suggesting Alaska get there. Everything we have has been passed for a reason. But it gives you an idea on how much simpler it is when a company tries to look at an economic model for other areas and an economic model for the state of Alaska.
But just for clarity, North Dakota has a tax and royalty system.
Yes.
We have a concession system.
Yes.
You can't, my understanding, there's no way you can get a concession system as simple as a tax and royalty system.
You're absolutely right, Mr. Chairman. And as I'm saying, I'm not proposing that we scrap our current system to do what North Dakota is doing. I'm just pointing out that this is an issue that we hear about over and over again that just makes it more difficult and less investor-friendly in Alaska. It's just a hurdle that we have to deal with that other areas don't. Moving on to slide 8, which is another section of the bill that is an allowance for production increases. If the barrels increase in production by a company over the previous year's level, it would effectively reduce the production tax value by $10 per additional barrel, only for the base rate, so $2.50 per additional barrel. The benefit would be calculated and refunded by the Department of Revenue after the production tax calculation is done. Based on the department's fall 2011 forecast, it would reduce revenue by less than $25 million total for all companies for all years. So it would be a much more complicated piece for the department to administer as well as for companies, and it would give very, very little benefit.
And if you want to, or later, talk about the concept.
Sure. We will touch on that later, Mr. Chairman. Okay. To give you an example of this, on slide 9, a major producer produces 200,000 barrels a day, invests $1 billion per year to achieve a modest decline rate in the legacy fields. If they were to invest a lot more and, say, increase production 5% to 210,000 barrels a day and were to maintain that level for several years, the first-year benefit they would get from this is $9.1 million. And if that level didn't go up another amount the second year and stayed at 210,000, they would receive zero benefit of this in the out years. And the slide 10 just pretty much summarizes what I just said, as we see a very small benefit, likely for 1 year, with no benefit for maintaining that higher level of production. It would be more difficult for the department to track and calculate. And we'll discuss the suggestions, which would be to replace this with something that incentivized new fields with reduced tax rates, or something that would be seen as a more substantial change and something that would be a benefit of more likely multiple years as opposed to 1 year. The next piece of the bill that we would like to discuss on slide 11 is the 10% gross minimum tax for certain fields. It applies only to units with over 1 billion barrels of cumulative production and over 100,000 barrels per day in the most recent year. So effectively, it applies to Prudhoe and Kuparuk. Puts a hard floor in which credits can't be used to reduce the tax for these fields below 10% of gross value. It also tweaks community revenue sharing provisions. And based on our current fall 2011 forecast, it increases revenue by less than $25 million per year. And when the price of oil drops to $40 a barrel, it increases revenues to the state by over $400 million a year. And we'll have a graph that graphs out the change to that in comparison to current law, so you can see the effect on it as we get to the low end of lower priced barrels. The state of Alaska takes in a far greater amount than it does currently. And on slide 12, you do see that this is graphing out the gross minimum tax versus the current law production tax revenue in millions on the left-hand side and ANS West Coast on the bottom. You can see that there's a small tax increase at the higher end. And at the low end, in particular, $40 a barrel and less, there's a huge tax increase to companies.
So what? Tell me what causes this.
Mr. Chairman, what causes it is putting in a hard floor, basically saying companies will pay at a certain level. They will pay taxes and are not allowed to take credits on those taxes, because as you get down to a low enough cost of oil, you get to a point where the amount of tax credits that a company qualifies for could very well surpass what they'd be paying in tax. And this would be putting in a hard floor and basically saying that a company, no matter how low the price gets, will always pay some taxes, regardless of what their tax credits might be for that particular year.
Right, I should have clarified my question, made it a little easier, I think. The issue here is when in 12, I think we're looking at, what, $400 million in credits? That's half of our credits. There's another 400 and roughly, or 325 or some number in there. But that 400 dealing with Prudhoe and Kuparuk swings into our tax revenue and basically erases it and drives it to zero and, in fact, could drive it negative. And that was pointed out also by several of our consultants, Pedro Van Meers being the last one. So as we move these different levers, we need to come back and check these, because these numerics are going to change as we change our tax structure. If we change progressivity or change credits or – isn't that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman. And through the ACES debate, initially there was a floor in – and I believe the floor was taken out, so the state would take more on the high end. Well, this bill puts the floor back in, but doesn't really increase substantially anything on the high end. So it's a tax increase on the low end and a minimal tax reduction on the high end. This bill would also change potentially change community revenue sharing. We don't believe that it would ultimately have it would not be likely to have an effect on what we believe the price of oil and what we believe the production would be, but it could potentially, and it increases the complexity of the calculation. So we're not entirely clear what the benefit of this particular piece of the bill is, but we don't see a benefit to the state. We just see it increasing the complexity.
Can we back up real quick to slide 12? This is going on to a different subject matter. I think as we go forward, it would be nice in our presentations to work on the clarity with the community or the committee on what drives our PPT underwater. And if we were to do some form of a floor or some minimum protection for the state, how would we handle the credits that were being put to the state, and how would they be carried forward, and how would that be treated so we don't look at it and just as a one-year snapshot, but we look at it at the overall effect to the state and the producers. We haven't had that type of conversation yet, but I think that should be part of this discussion with the floor.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, and we're isolating these piece by piece, but as you mentioned before, they all work together, and that increases the complexity, but the department is certainly able to work with the committee to make sure that any change or any discussed change in any piece of tax law can be looked at, not just specifically and individually, but also how it changes things as a whole. Slide 13, it's just kind of a summary slide of what we've discussed on the gross minimum tax. The provision will impact some companies at current prices, and it creates a substantial tax increase at lower prices. The department believes it creates a disincentive to investment in Prudhoe and Kuparuk, which, as we all know, is where the majority of our production has come from and will continue to come from, certainly in the short term. The mechanism would require the Department of Revenue to track and calculate the benefit, and the department is not in favor of this particular piece of the bill. Slide 15 discusses the Petroleum Information System, which would be a new information system to be implemented by the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. It would be operational before January 1st of 2014. We're going to defer to AOGCC, who will be coming before the committee, I understand, to discuss this in more detail. However, we have talked to them, and they are very much not in favor of this particular piece, and they can go into more detail, but they believe that it's cost prohibitive as well as it diverts them from what they see their mission as. The committee might consider the need for this in context of the efforts the Department of Revenue has done to make more information available. We have certainly begun to collect information that the department previously had statutorily been able to collect but had not been collecting. We got that process going this last summer. We expect to have far more detailed information going forward starting in calendar year 12, which we would be getting the information in calendar year 13, and we'd be happy to present details on that at a later date if the committee so chooses.
Yes, I think we'll have AOGCC before the committee Friday on the subject matter, and it may not be the appropriate place to locate information, and we may have to work on the language after we get spun up a little bit on what the department's doing. We'll have a later hearing on that this particular issue to flush it out more, and then the committee will do its process on how it wants to react to what the differences between what they feel they should have or the public should have access to in the legislature versus where the department currently is with the proposed changes that you're talking about, some of which we're not aware of yet. We haven't got that far, so we'll cross that bridge here in
That's correct. A couple weeks.
Slide
16 touches on decoupling. The language had been put into the bill identical to 2010 session Senate Bill 305. We won't go into detail on this. I know, Mr. Chairman, we're still working with you as well as others on coming up with a solution on this that we can all agree on. We hope to have something to the committee sometime in the very near future, the next week or two. So we're pointing this out just to mention that it's in the bill, but I also wanted to give an update on the work we've been doing internally on it.
And just for those watching home, maybe just briefly tell us what this is.
Sure. This particular piece of it would currently oil and gas is coupled together. So when a company is paying taxes to the state of Alaska, oil and gas is combined and taxed together, and tax credits are used together. And this would decouple the taxes paid on oil and taxes paid on gas separately, because it could result in a situation that if a company began to sell large, if there was a major gas sale, that the state of Alaska could potentially bring less revenue in as a result of a major gas sale than it would by standalone oil taxes itself.
In the billions.
That's correct.
To the negative. And then currently, I think you sent me a letter on the earlier, or the committee, currently the dilution effect we're facing in 12 in our current system is roughly what magnitude?
Mr. Chairman, it's approximately $80 million.
Correct. That's correct. Currently we're facing an $80 million dilution today without any gas sales. So the concern is if we have a large gas sale, that number is going to escalate substantially, and it could. We've seen numbers in a couple billion range. So
that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so I'll continue to work with the department on that, and hopefully we can bring that work to the committee when we have the linking issue of gas and oil, when then we have that discussion at the committee. So I'm going to try to delay that until we can work this out. If not, we'll work with the language we have. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Commissioner, you stated what the position is on the other components of the legislation, and you did not say what the position was on this particular component. I wonder if you could address that.
I'm sure, through the Chair, Senator Hoffman. The administration's position on this is the same as it was when SB 305 passed, that the governor still has very serious concerns with the language as proposed. And that's why we're working with Senator Steadman to come up with language that can accomplish what we hope to accomplish in decoupling oil and gas, while at the same time being more revenue neutral and allaying some of the concerns the governor has.
Okay, go ahead, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Butcher, as you looked at this decoupling issue and the difference between the Cook Inlet gas versus gas produced throughout the part of the state, what's the administration's position on this delineation between the two production air sites? Do you understand the question?
No.
Go ahead,
Chairman Senator Olson.
As you look at point number two up there, gas, other than Cook Inlet gas, and it's on point one up there, where there's a difference between gas that's produced in Cook Inlet versus other gas produced, say, on the North Slope, for an example. What's the governor's position on, or what's the administration's position on the delineation between those two taxing regimes that are obviously from very different sites, servicing very different parts of the population, either in the state or otherwise?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I will have to get back to the committee on that. I haven't talked in any detail with the governor about how he sees the relation of oil taxes, gas taxes in the Cook Inlet area compared to what goes on the North Slope.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If you can get back to the committee on those responses.
Yeah, we'll do that, Mr. Chair. Slide 17 shows a more easily viewed columns of comparing current law, ACEs, comparing CS for SB 192, and then comparing the governor's bill on the differences in progressivity, the differences in maximum tax rate, new production incentives, as well as a minimum tax.
And if you could give us a brief history of, seems like you've got HB 110 on here, which isn't a bill before us, but it's a subject matter before us. Where that bill came from?
House Bill 110 is Governor Parnell's bill that was introduced at the beginning of the last legislative session. And the reason, Mr. Chairman, we're referencing it is trying to give an idea of where the administration sees substantive change. And as I'd mentioned before, that there are different ways to get to a point in which we believe a material difference has been made in the investment climate for the state of Alaska. And House Bill 110 is one way to do it. It can be done other ways, but we have it on there for the benefit, for the purpose of being able to graph it so you can see where effective tax rates and other things are for that particular legislation that companies have testified would make a material difference in their investment decisions compared to where the current law is, to give a general idea of an area that we can be working into that may have benefit based on what we've heard over the prior year from that bill.
Okay. And then maybe in the future date, you can add the original submission of that bill. I think there's quite a bit of difference as we track our process along.
Mr. Chairman, we can do that. The major elements of the bill are the same, but there have been some smaller tweaks and changes to it that have occurred as it's gone through the process. Slide 18 shows effective production tax rates, with the black line being ACE's current law, the red line being the current SB 192 in front of us, and then the blue line being the governor's bill. And this has to do with unitized fields that are currently producing on the North Slope, showing from $60 to $300 a barrel of oil, and what the effective production tax rate would be on the left side at each of those places.
And we've had testimony here from our consultants that doesn't need to be any significant changes in the current production tax structure. The issue at hand would be incremental production above the 6% decline curve, which we're trying to get to with the 10% allowance. So there seems to be quite a spread here between the red and the blue. If this is concerning current production, which is what I understand it is, our consultants recommending to us that our tax structure isn't that far off under current production, but we've got problems with incremental increases. So how do you help the committee rectify that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the department disagrees, if you're referring to Pedro Van Meers, the department disagrees with Mr. Van Meers on that particular aspect of it. And so that's something we can certainly work on and discuss as the bill it moves through, but we don't make the assumption that that not incentivizing what's currently been going on. We believe that the tax structure right now is too high, and it's too high for current production. It would be too high for new production.
Okay. I think you'll see the committee separate the argument in two major camps. One of them will be the current production, and another one will be an incremental production over the 6% decline curve, and what does that cost in capital dollars going in, and then what kind of a tax structure should be in place on that. So we may have a, at least initially, we most likely will have a we'll agree to disagree. And, you know, work that out as we move on. We'll probably be interested then in looking at some of your government take numbers, which I think come in later on in your presentation, and discuss some of that stuff.
Sure, Mr. Chairman.
But let me just clarify a little bit on that. The current tax structure, as I recall, in and around the $100 range, but as you go north, 150, 140, in this graph, 200, the consultants are saying we got a problem with our tax structure, even under current production. Mm-hmm. So I just want the public to try to parse that current production and the current tax structure, but you got to make sure you understand what dollar the range in oil prices we're referring to.
Right.
So we'll probably have some discussion at the table.
We look forward to that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Slide 19 graphs out the lines of the impact of the 10% gross tax, with the black line again being current law, the red line being the bill we have in front of us, and then the blue line being the governor's bill. And as you can see, when the price of oil drops under SB 192, the percentage tax rate that a company would pay shoots up, eventually getting to 100%. Slide 20 shows the marginal government take that we had discussed briefly earlier, Mr. Stickle had discussed. The black line showing the marginal take under current ACES law, the red being SB 192, and as you can see, there is a shift there, and then a change at approximately $240 a barrel where the marginal take drops. And then the blue line would be the governor's bill, which has a less aggressive marginal government take.
And then if you, again, just kind of repeating, but for those watching at home, tell me why this chart wouldn't have much validity at $300 a barrel.
Why it would have...
With CapEx and OpEx being held.
Less validity at what?
300, on your extreme at $300 a barrel. The issue being... Again, CapEx and OpEx is a variable expenditure. Some of it's fixed, but
Mr. Chairman,
it's
the it would eventually hit a cap where it wouldn't continue. The progressivity wouldn't be in effect. Additional dollars that the price of oil went up wouldn't continue to increase the percentage take that government would be receiving.
I guess if I could back up again, I don't, these are good in representation on how the mathematics work, but if oil prices spiked to $240 a barrel, CapEx and OpEx would go right through the ceiling and chase it, which would bring the bring you down the x-axis again. So
eventually that would occur, yes, right. Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. I would like to reference something the Commissioner did mention. When we did experience a pretty significant spike from the $40 up to the $140 over a very short period, and during that time, it was such a short period that capital expenditures probably did not have time to react. So, again, it's that high end for perhaps a brief few months that would be taken away from the upper end for the companies. So while we should look at it in two ways, the continuing steady increase in price that's sustained or the spikes that happen, such as what we've seen recently. So I think it's two different scenarios that are possible.
Maybe it'd be a good time to explain to the public how we calculate this in a time window. Monthly, averaging our costs annually. You want to highlight that a little bit?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the tax itself is payable. It's payable on a monthly basis, so the companies do make a monthly calculation based on the monthly share of the annual costs. So we will get a payment each month from the company, and the progressivity portion will be calculated on the price and the production tax value in that month.
Monthly average.
Correct.
And then this, and annually, and we sum the average. We sum it up, the 12 of them.
Correct. Right. There's a annual reconciliation, but the tax is a monthly tax.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, at the lower end under HB 110, the stair-stepping here is a result of bracketing, and you know, and why is the administration so set on bracketing versus the current system under ACES and that being proposed under 192?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, as we began looking at the drafting of this bill a little over a year ago, and we looked at progressivity in other areas, virtually every jurisdiction that uses progressivity brackets, and in fact PFC Energy, the legislature's consultants said the same thing in the previous committee, and that really makes the state of Alaska an outlier in how it, a company would potentially look at investing, because virtually everybody else brackets. And to explain a little bit about specifically how brackets work, they would work. The best way for the public to be able to visualize it would be it's similar to what you pay in your federal income tax, where from zero to $15,000 of your income is taxed at a certain percent, 10%. And then $15,000 to $25,000. And as you get up into a higher tax bracket, the higher percentages you have to pay on those next brackets of your earnings, but you never go back. All Americans would pay the same lower tax on that first $15,000 or $20,000 worth of earnings. That's how brackets would work, which would be a company would pay taxes at a higher and higher bracket based on the price of oil, but only pay it on that particular, whether it's a $5 bracket or a $10 bracket, whereas the way Alaska does it now, when you get up to a higher and higher tax rate, that tax rate is applied to the entire barrel of oil. And that's the reason why we see such high marginal rates. That's why at $100, $105, you're seeing 90% of that dollar coming in going to government, because you're not just paying a higher tax because the price of oil went up. You're then applying that tax to the entire barrel. So as we looked at it, we realized that bracketed made it not so severe on the high end, where companies could not only could companies keep more on the high end than they can under current law, but it would also bring us in with virtually any other jurisdiction that uses progressivity.
So we want to look like everybody else.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there's a benefit to it that I think everybody else is getting that we are not.
But can you not, if you're going to deal with the marginal rate, if you're concerned, the marginal rate, I think, peaks out, well, I think currently at $92.50 of profit oil. It's after all the expenses, roughly $30 a barrel to, so you're looking at maybe 125, 130, which is about where we are today. So I guess today would be a good example. If we went out in the marketplace, the industry would be at about its maximum marginal tax structure. And then if the rate advances, then the marginal rate's going to drop down, it'll come down that little cliff. But that can be modified in numerous ways, can it not, by just changing the slope of progressivity, changing the base tax, moving different levers?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not saying that we should move to brackets because it would bring down the marginal rate. I'm saying that the marginal rate is high. A big reason the marginal rate is so high is because we don't bracket, and that would just be one benefit to it.
And Mr. Chairman, part of the discussions that went on during the when we were putting HB 110 together, we what we've heard from other jurisdictions and companies is, you know, there's a couple parts that they look at. Obviously, it's are you stable and is your tax simple? We have not been stable, and our tax is certainly not simple. So our goal was not to throw out the entire tax structure and start over. It was to work within the structure that's been in place for the last couple of years. So we discussed a new kickoff point. We chose to stay with the $30, and we chose to deal with the brackets and adjust the cap. So again, that, you know, that was part of the discussion. Do we start at $60 progressivity, or do we keep it at 30? So that's clearly an option that we discussed internally also as a possible adjustment.
So then HB 110 then came out of revenue, Department of Revenue. We still don't know where the bill came from.
Yes, it did. It came out of the Department of Revenue working with the Department of Natural Resources.
Okay. And one of the concerns we have, if we follow the advice of our consultants saying that there's not that much adjustment that needs to take place under current production, current price roughly at $100 is a reference number that was used, even though today's price is a little higher than that. But at $100, if the government take number doesn't need to be moved, then by throwing in bracketings, you would substantially change that. So we'd have to go then in turn increase something else to keep everything else the same, cash flow, net cash flow to the state. Because at the end of the day, that's the issue in the middle of the table, is splitting profit oil, which is the production tax value, and who gets production tax value is not the profit oil, but I don't want to clarify that misspeak, but who gets the net cash flow between the state, the industry, and the federal government? So at the end of the day, when we look at whatever adjustment, if it happens to be here with bracketing, we still got to boil it down to the net cash flow and then ask ourselves, is that an adequate share to be returned to the state and the industry under a given particular price? But if you assume $100, it doesn't move, and just assume that for conversations, then we have to move something else to implement this bracketing because it moves a substantial amount of cash flow.
If you were trying to keep things the way they are today, yes, yeah, you would have to make a change.
Mm-hmm. But the point of the HB 110 was not to stay revenue neutral to the state. We believe the pendulum swung out too far under ACEs, so which is then affecting the production curve. So our goal was to reduce the revenue take by the state, increase the revenue take by the industry in order to generate more cash flow under these oil prices. So again, it wasn't, our goal was not revenue neutral. Our goal was to increase production, and we believed making it a little more simple and obviously reducing the curve is the biggest part, but making it a little more simple also would be a benefit to both the state and the industry.
Just as a, you know, just for an added comment, so people kind of put in context, when we did progressivity initially, and we'll get into this later, what it is and why it's in place, it's to keep the percent of the share going to the state from declining. Again, the share to the state to stop it from declining as prices went up. And we used that to neutralize our regressive tax structure. And now it's become regressive, and we're having a discussion, is that too much so on that side of the scale? But we had difficulty in pegging it to some numeric. We couldn't do it on a rate of return basis because we don't know the rates of return to the industry. The only thing we know for relative certain is the price, the market price, because we go in and verify it. So it's tied to price. I think we'd be open to a discussion to tie it to a rate of return, but I think that would be not well received.
And Mr. Chairman, we're not suggesting that we get rid of progressivity. We're comfortable with progressivity. We just think adjustments need to be made.
Okay.
Slide 21 takes a look at the share of profit under current law. This includes the profits defined, as we've mentioned earlier, as the total gross value of oil produced less the transportation costs and the lease expenditures. And this would include royalty oil, all taxes in what the profits would be split out between the federal government in red, the state of Alaska in green, and the producing companies in blue. And as you can see, at today's oil, $120, a little bit north of $115, state of Alaska takes in 56-57%, the federal government 15%, and companies 27-28%. This is under current law.
Chairman, if we can just stop there for a minute. The federal tax used in the calculation for the industry is 35?
Right. Mr. Chairman, we're using the 35% nominal rate for federal income tax. And one of the things that does is by using the nominal rates, it simplifies when you start comparing to other jurisdictions. That simplifies that comparison quite a bit.
Right. So a couple of points. One is some of us have a conceptual problem believing that they actually pay 35%, that that's in fact the rate, even if you took the rate of BP, Conoco, and Exxon and averaged them, or weighted them for their interest in the state, or took the maximum one, or however you want to cut that pie. Some of us don't necessarily, or would be surprised if they pay 35% federal rate, because they have depletion allowances and all other kinds of mechanisms and other things going on. But for comparison, I understand 35% being the maximum rate under the federal tax laws. That's what we use to compare across jurisdictions and for comparative purposes. But when we're counting net cash flow, which is, again, the game in the middle of the table, and if you take your eye off of that, you're playing some other game. It's certainly not what's going on. The consultants recommended that we have somewhere around 75% government take on our existing fields. So if you take your slide, that equates to about $140 barrel oil. So there was concern above 75% that the state would be taking too big of a share of profit oil. So under that discussion, 140 would be the cap, would be a 25% to the industry, and then like that 19% then would, in a theoretical world, disappear. It'd be held at 25. So their marginal impact would be pretty much stationary going forward. My understanding is one of the biggest concerns the industry has is if prices advance, say as an example here, from $90, which wasn't too long ago, we were in the $90-$100 range, out to the, say, $190 range, their cut would go from 33% to 23%. That's what they don't like. And they'll certainly speak for themselves, and I'm going to ask them. Because they, even though they don't use 190, when I'll ask them that, I expect them not to use 190 in their analysis for rates of return and decision making. But if in fact the price went to 190, they don't want to see their cut going from 33 to 23. They want a flat cut.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, as you said, they'll certainly testify to their feelings on that. I feel like when you look at this, you need to look at it two different ways, one of which is you need to look at what seems reasonable for government take compared to company take, and then you've also got to compare how we look compared to other jurisdictions that a company may be looking at. And when Pedro Van Meers testified in front of the committee, he pointed out that our who we're competing with now is much different than who we were competing with 10 or 15 years ago. We're now competing against North Dakota, against Canada, against Texas, and then he mentioned a couple of countries. And when you look at what our government take is compared to those, the companies see a much greater benefit in those areas than here. So it's more than just looking internally. That's an important piece of it. But we also need to be aware that if we're not competitive to where other dollars are going, we're not going to get the investment dollars that we could be getting. And I think that's what we're looking at today.
Just a point of clarification. He didn't use North Dakota. I don't have it here in front of me, the three or four, but we can get that to you. Gabon was one of them. There's three or four of them. They were all exporting countries, exporting meaning they had access to the ocean and moved oil around. So we can clarify that, but that, I think
he might have said North America. And I just included the largest oil-producing jurisdictions in North America.
But he was the one that recommended the 75% number in the context of what he perceived as our competitive environment. He was taking that into account to justify his numeric to the committee.
But what I'm saying is we're not competitive there percentage-wise, and I don't know, I haven't talked to him about this specifically, on if he believes our current law makes us competitive compared to those other jurisdictions, but nothing we've looked at shows any information like that.
And I think looking at some of the graphs that we've put together, it's not included in here, but obviously he had a big hand in PPT when it was passed. And PPT to ACES as introduced wasn't a huge delta. So that change remained in the ballpark. It's the ACES as passed. That's the issue that we have. So he put a lot of work into PPT, and I think if you look at where PPT is compared to ACES as passed, that tremendous delta there is what we're seeing now over the last 5 years as the issue. And while $140 might be a place to discuss where the problem may begin, we haven't spent much time in the $140 price range for ANS. It was a very, very short time. So we see that problem being much lower than $140. And that's our position, is we're seeing these issues happen here compared to what's taking place in other oil-producing jurisdictions where they are seeing increases. We think the problem starts below 100 somewhere, certainly. But $140, we believe, is not the appropriate part to start the discussion. We think that number should probably be quite a bit lower.
So do you think our government take number should be 67%?
Senator Passman, we think the government take should be the appropriate government take, or Senator Stedman, to
he's an attorney. I count the money, so we're probably your worst nightmare.
We believe the government take should be whatever is appropriate to make us competitive. And right now, we don't believe the we believe the government take is too high.
At above $90, is that? I mean, you got it. I mean, at $150, I'd agree with you. But at what? Just to clarify the administration's position, at what price range? Because we're dealing here with the three majors. What price range is that? Is that? Am I hearing you correct at $90?
Mr. Chairman, internally we've kind of discussed $70. The governor, at a press conference a week or so ago, said he believed between $60 and $80 we were comfortable, but anything north of that. So that's the general area we've looked at.
I wish you luck, because looking back at PPT, there's no way that you're going to get support that I could see in the legislature to take a rate below PPT. I mean, it's just, I don't think it could be justified, and we'll talk about that. And I'll give you the guys the opportunity to justify those type of government take numbers. But I think, and we'll have PFC Energy speak for themselves, and we'll be asking them. I would expect them to be, you know, not in agreement with Pedro and Mears, but I would expect them to be within a ballpark range. It would not be in the mid 60s. For current production, I'm not talking about incremental issues. Incremental production is a whole other ball game.
Right.
And I'm not talking about high dollar prices at $140, $150. I'd agree with you, we got problems. But when we get down in the $80, $90, $70, we go back to PPT. We've had industries testify and ask for rates of 15% base tax, 18%, and, you know, below the old 20%. And, we're at 25.
And that's something certainly we look forward to discussing. There is no perfect tax bill. There's no perfect number where if you go one up, you lose investment, and if you go one down, you gain tremendous amount of investment. It's a matter of working together and determining where we need to be and then discussing it with companies and hearing, their read on it.
Could you, on this chart, could you, for the committee, because we don't have the ability, we don't have the information you do to parse out the legacy fields, so could you run this chart again? Well, you got it at 35%, and maybe footnote it here on the tax structure so we keep them straight, because we'll have multiple runs made over time. But the 35% tax, federal tax rate, which you have, and then, cut it in half. Or run one at 25 and run one at 20. I just want to see how these bars move around under those federal rates. I don't know what that rate is, the federal rate that they pay, and we're going to use most likely 35% most of the time, but I want to have a good feel for what happens when that rate changes.
Okay,
should be a fairly linear relationship, so running a couple of runs should give us that feel.
We can run those. What would you be basing 20% on?
The wind. I don't know if they pay a 25% federal rate or they pay a 35% federal rate, but if I, as a betting man, I'd bet that it's not 35%, it's some other number. And if 35% is the maximum, it's got to be below that. So I'm just picking a number out of the air. You could run a 25 and a 20, because it should be a fairly linear relationship. I just want to get a feel for the sensitivity of what we're dealing with. Because they, the industry, we've asked them, they're not going to tell us what their corporate rate is, other than it's 35%. But I want to know the sensitivity of what we're dealing with if that rate changes, and the impact to them. Because we want to make sure we get this as right as we can. And this includes credits, correct?
Yes.
And the credit under FY12, right?
Yes.
$400 million. Okay.
Within the FY12 numbers, correct? Yes, yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and I think that'll help, and then it would be nice to run these again in the so-called homogenized. What does it look like for everybody? In other words, what does it look like when we say at $90 a barrel, and they say it's 49%, as an example here in this bar, and we tell you to put the 49% in cash on the table and stack it up. We want to count it. You have to take in the explorers, which have credits but no production, which brings our tax revenue down. Again, I want to boil it down to the net cash. So,
from a state perspective?
Right. I'm not asking you to count the cash in the slide, right, but I'm saying that's why I want to look at a slide that has the aggregate Arctic in it. Because this is just basically the three major producers, and maybe there's another guy in there or something, but basically there's three big players in the middle of the table that pay our tax. But this is not the rate that affects the net to the Treasury.
Right. This is looking at it from a point of view of a company that's paying, that has a tax liability to the state.
And for simplicity, we're just going to count it as the big three so we don't razzle or dazzle us and we get confused. So, and then we'll just compare that to a slide of everybody so we can get a feel for the delta. Because a lot of the presentations we've had in the past is in the aggregate, and the numbers do change.
Right.
And sometimes when we look at the aggregate and we set the policy, underneath that policy is the big three, they're paying a tax structure that we didn't recognize, and it causes some indigestion. So we need to be clear on what's going on with 500,000 barrels a day, which is the big three, and then what's going on with the other 100 roughly, and how does that interplay? There's another way of looking at it. Senator Hoffman.
Well, this may be a little bit off the subject, Mr. Chairman, but since North Dakota was mentioned, North Dakota, much of their land is privately owned and taxed by royalty to private owners, not government take, but still a tax to the oil producers. The producers have to pay. How can we use that as a fair comparison to Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, each jurisdiction we look at is difficult to make comparisons to, and you highlight a piece of it. And what we would have to do at that point is to set aside the royalty piece of it, because we're the owners in this state, private owners in North Dakota, and look at what the actual taxes that a company would pay in North Dakota compared to what a company would pay in the state of Alaska.
So you're saying that there is a way to make a fair comparison?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there's a way to make a more fair comparison. But even in that situation, we can say, okay, here's North Dakota and here's Alaska. You still have to look at the fact that, North Dakota, there's roads everywhere. They can drive to any of their developments. They can work 365 days of the year. There's a workforce that's within a pickup truck's drive of wherever they need to go, and that's not the issue we're having to deal with here. And so there are always other issues that need to be discussed when you're trying to compare the two, and even when you can do apples to apples, it doesn't give you the entire picture.
And isn't one of the major parts of the puzzle prospectivity? Basin progress prospectivity?
Yes.
Put it in English, the size of your hydrocarbon basin.
That is correct, where a company would be more likely to put more money into the potential for a larger reservoir than a smaller reservoir.
Right. And are we equal to North Dakota?
Mr. Chairman, we're far in excess of North Dakota. Alberta, I believe, is the only province or state that has reserves in excess of the state of Alaska.
Right, I'd agree with that. I think and these are just rough terms, and we can have our consultant come back with some information on this, Senator Hoffman, because that subject comes up as comparative. I think roughly North Dakota has about a 250-foot or 300-foot of shale oil in thickness. I think we have three layers totaling about 1,000 feet. They pale in comparison to the state of Alaska. We have a you know, a state held in commons, subsurface held in commons, where they have privatized subsurface rights, along with Texas and all the other states. So it's very difficult to make a direct comparison.
That's true, Mr. Chairman. And the fact that in the next 12 months, North Dakota expects to pass the state of Alaska in their production kind of highlights even more what we could be doing that we're not doing to incentivize more development here.
Well, it gets into a whole other subject of basin economics and basin control, but we can take that up another time. Senator Hoffman.
But, you know, you say that, but how quick are they going to, how long are they going to hold that, and then because of the difference in reserves, how quick are they going to descend?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that's a good question. They expect to be rising for quite a number of years, but there is a time, because they are dealing with much smaller reservoirs in the state of Alaska, that they will be declining. And they keep changing what they believe their down years will be, but they certainly will probably be occurring before the state of Alaska.
Well, let's get back on track. We'll come back to talk about these basin comparisons and the difference between Texas and their stripper wells and North Dakota and Alaska, and we'll clarify some of that stuff because there are definitely a lot of differences. Well, let's go on to the next slide.
Sure.
So we stay on track here. We got about 35 minutes left. And if we don't quite finish, that's fine. I don't want to rush the department. I'd rather go through this information at a comfortable pace, and we have some spillover time this afternoon at 1 to finish up in case we run short, because the last thing I want to do is start rushing presentations and then have the information not properly digested by the committee.
We appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. 21, 22, and slide 23 are all making a comparison between the share of profit under slide 21 is the current law. Slide 22 would be under SB 192, and in comparison to the previous slide, you're going to see a shift from government to producers of approximately 1% to 2%, depending on what the price of oil is, with the exception at low oil prices, where you're going to see a substantial shift from producer to government. And then as we look at slide 23, that would be a slide of the share of profit under the governor's bill. You would see the share, the percentage moving from government to producer at a higher percentage than under current law or under SB 192, but still, as you can see, in the a little under a third to a little over a third based on the price of oil at about $120 a barrel, would be looking at about a two-thirds government, one-third producer share of profit.
And then on these slides, when you, and I assume that you got the fancy analytical software, the modeling available, so it's, we're not asking, you know, for a lot of work just to rerun these. But can you put them in dollars?
Yes, we can do that, Mr. Chairman. In fact, we have slides that do just that, so it would be no problem at all.
Right, because the percentage issue, sometimes we'll talk about percentage, and then sometimes we'll talk about it in dollars. But I don't think the industry likes their percent of the pie shrinking any more than the state did under original PPT when the state's percentage shrunk. So it's uncomfortable whoever's in the shrinking position.
That is correct. We know more than anybody the difficulties, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And the last handful of slides will focus on what we believe are suggested improvements that could be done to the bill. Brackets, which we've talked about, lowering the cap on progressivity, which is currently 75%, though this bill would reduce it to 60%, and we would suggest 50%. Reduced tax for new fields, which in the governor's bill would be about 10% less for fields that have never been developed compared to current law, and then increased credits for infield drilling. And these are the major components in the governor's bill, so we're not coming to the table with some radical new ideas. This is just to lay these out. So,
Senator Hoffman.
Well, depending upon how each one of these are addressed and how aggressively are these listed in priority, or I say that they wouldn't be depending upon what the rate may be on progressivity or what the brackets are, but are these categorized in priority?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we believe all of these address a different piece of what can be done to benefit production in Alaska. However, if we were to pick a piece that probably has more focus, should have more focus than any other, it would be the progressivity piece of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And slide 24.
If you can hold it.
One other issue. There's two issues on progressivity here, bracketing and lowering the cap. Either one of those or both of those?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, brackets are going to have a more substantial effect on investment, we believe, if you had to pick between one of the two of them. But putting a cap on it at high prices is also would also be seen as a benefit, I think, in our investment climate.
But the brackets are a fix to a problem. What's the problem?
The problem, Mr. Chairman, the problem is that we are taking a higher the government's taking a higher piece of the profit share, and as a result of that, we believe companies' investments are going other places where they can make a higher return than they can make in the state of Alaska.
So shouldn't that be the number one issue then, is to solve the problem versus implement a particular solution to the problem?
Mr. Chairman, we've dealt with this bill as a whole. I haven't sat down and discussed with the governor what's 1A, what's 1B, what's 2. So I feel a little uncomfortable splitting it apart. That's certainly a conversation I can have and get back to the committee.
I would think that the split of the profit oil is number one at high oil prices. That's the key, and there's lots of levers we can push and pull to get the job done. But we just need to make sure we're counting net cash flow in the end, so neither party, we don't really get too concerned about the federal government, but the industry and the state isn't surprised at the outcome.
That is correct. And so bracketed progressivity, we've talked about this in some detail already, so I won't get into too much detail about it, other than we think that this would be a great benefit to the state of Alaska. Slide 26 shows the marginal tax rate graphed for bracketed progressivity between current law, and if you were to take current law and bracket it, put it in bracketed progressivity as opposed to how current law is. And you can see that it's a much more gradual marginal tax increase as the price of oil goes up compared to current law.
If we could back up a slide, if we could, 25 here, or a couple slides, I guess. One of the things we haven't talked about today or mentioned, just as a beginning presentation item, is the issue of, in any magnitude anyway, the issue of negative production tax value, where we're driven underwater at low prices, but also the issue of gold plating at higher prices, where the after the impact of credits and deductions, the state of Alaska is paying us a substantial portion in the federal government of capital expenditures. You want to highlight that? Should I re-ask the question? More straight, I could put it in.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, the concept with gold plating relates, it's kind of the inverse of the marginal tax rate discussion, where the marginal tax rate looks at the fact that as you add a dollar of value, the state takes a significant portion, exceeding 80% at certain prices, and if you include all government take, exceeding 90%. The inverse of that is that the state would pay potentially the vast majority of the cost for an additional dollar of investment. And there's some concern, the term gold plating refers to the concept that a company could potentially alter their decisions and spend money on something that might not be the most prudent investment, so-called gold plating.
So as an example, if we had a structure in place where it was, say, over 100%, 105%, for instance, the industry, you know, a particular company then could go hog wild and build all kinds of stuff and send the bill to somebody else, basically.
Right, and that is a concern when you get into these situations where you have very high marginal tax rates. Mm-hmm. So it's distortionary both on the tax side and on the spending side.
Right, that's a gross simplification I've just made, but it, I think it gets to the point, and the concern has been brought up by our consultants that we need to address that issue in our tax structure. The state of Alaska shouldn't be put in a position at high oil prices where we're us and the federal government are covering the vast majority, maybe it's 90 in around there percent of the costs. It's not a position the state should be in, or to drive the production tax value negative too early let me rephrase that. We need to be careful when the production tax value goes negative and recognize when that happens and deal with this credit issue, because credits are part of the problem, although I know it's not maybe a concern of the administration in the presentation here, but it's definitely a concern here at the table. So we'll be working on that issue also. And again, it all gets wrapped up into all these different maneuvers or levers that we're pushing and pulling. But the state of Alaska has some exposure under their current ACEs that the state of Alaska should not be facing.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's taking a look at the numbers, taking a look at the exposure, and determining what we're getting for that.
Right. Senator Hoffman.
I don't know. Is that a concern or is that not a concern? I think the chairman said it isn't a concern of the administration. Is it a concern?
It is. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it is a concern of the administration if we're looking at potentially a situation that's detrimental to the state of Alaska without getting a corresponding benefit that is in excess of that. You know, in certain situations, you can line a potential scenario up that might be detrimental, and in and of itself, you look at it and say, well, that doesn't make any sense. We need to do something to change that, but we need to understand what benefit that particular piece of law has that the state's getting in a larger context before going in and changing something very specifically. So it's kind of a long-winded way of saying we have concerns and we need to take a look at them and weigh the benefit, the cost-benefit analysis to it before making any changes.
Mr. Chairman, so you have concerns, but you don't have a solution at this point.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, to a specific situation, we would be happy to come up with an example. But we're talking more conceptually right now than we're talking specifically, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we'll work on that as we go forward, as we put this mosaic together. We don't want to have a toxic cocktail when we're done.
No, we don't.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay, slide 27 shows the bracketed progressivity effective production tax rate after credits, and as you can see, it's also a slope that goes up as a result of moving to brackets, but it's a much more gradual slope than we have under current law.
So if we just made a simplified system and said we want a tax on gross, what would that look like to equate the same amount of dollars in the tax structure? At $120 a barrel.
Through the chair, or excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I don't have that off the top of my head. That's certainly something we can do.
Well, okay. Excluding royalties. Can you help me with that? Or you want to get back to me on it?
Yeah, I think we would prefer to get back to you with a specific as opposed to kind of flying by the seat of our pants and ending up forgetting a piece of it that we should have backed out. So, but that's something we can do fairly simply.
Okay, well, just use, for simplicity's sake, use $120 a barrel because it intersects basically the 30% line on your chart. I don't know where it is, in the high 40s, 47 or so in this chart. This is an example.
We'll do that, Mr. Chairman.
You get all these moving parts, but at the end of the day, again, it's the net.
Yep.
That we're got to pay attention to.
Slide 28 mentioned something that we've also already discussed, dealing with the lower cap on progressivity. Provides upside potential for a company as they look at their economic models. We currently are at 75%. Under SB 192, we'd move to 60%, which would apply at prices around $240 a barrel and higher. A 50% cap would apply at about around $140 a barrel. And as you've mentioned, Mr. Chairman, those also change as we get to higher barrels and OPEX and CAPEX costs go up. But a snapshot of today, that's the approximate area that these caps would go into play.
So we've had some discussion in a previous committee on having some updated analysis run on some fields. And I think the department has done that and is ready to present that when the committee is comfortable in the queue to have that done. Is that correct?
We can do that, Mr. Chairman. Having some, and we'd like to sit down with you and have some kind of an idea of specifically what you would want to look for in terms of what would be modeled.
Okay.
Because we have currently developing fields that are obviously economic because they're currently being developed. I would need to go back and look and see what fields were run during ACEs, because if they were potential fields that appeared economic under ACEs, they don't appear to be being developed because we haven't seen much happen in the last 5 years in terms of new fields coming online that weren't already started back in the 90s. So it would be beneficial to us to have a general idea of specifically what you'd want to look at, and we'd be happy to do that.
Okay. What we'll do is we'll get you the date of the presentation that was done. I think it was done by Econ One, put together. Dr. Fenica did it, or I think I pronounced his name right. We're having our consultants rerun those at the current OPEX and CAPEX and pricing ranges that we're in, which is substantially different from when Fenica ran them. And we'll get that to you so you guys could work with the consultants here in the next several days, and then we'll have some discussion over not only the past presentations and what those numbers would look like under the $100 barrel range or whatever versus the 60 or whatever they ran in. And I think the CAPEX is and OPEX is a double to triple. We'll make those adjustments so the committee then can see what the expectations and discussions were back when those presentations were delivered, what it looks like today under different pricing structure, and then we'll go on and have some discussion over this incremental return and or incremental production and cost and return on some of these other areas that we're working on to try to get increased production.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Slide 29 compares the lowering a cap on progressivity effective production tax rate, with the black being the 75%, the red being the reduction to 60% in SB 192, and then the blue being what at 192 would look like if you capped it at 50%. That's a fairly straightforward slide.
And if you could run that on a government take calculation, both in dollars and percentages, with this slide, so we can see the effect on government taking the net.
We'll do that for you, Mr. Chairman.
Because I think that's one of the discussions we're going to have is going forward is what do we want this scenario to look like, or tax structure to look like at $180 a barrel, for instance, 200 or 160.
We'll do that.
Okay, that should be.
Slide 30 is another piece, which is a reduced tax for new fields. The idea of providing a lower tax rate to incentivize new fields over the life of the project in areas that have not been developed. It wouldn't have a fiscal impact for many years. The average from exploration to production of a new field in the state of Alaska's 7 to 10 years, generally closer to the longer 10-year. And this is something, as we've talked about, increasing, flattening out, and then increasing production in the state. Short term, that would involve current fields, Prudhoe and Kuparuk. Also looking longer term is what this would have to do with in areas that have had very little, if any, previous exploration. And it would apply primarily to production that's not even in the Department of Revenue's current forecast. At this point, we wouldn't be losing any revenue because we're not receiving any revenue.
We probably want to be careful with that because eventually we'll have the revenue. It'll impact the state. So it's a leap to say that just because we don't have it today, we won't miss it tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, theoretically, at some point, we potentially could have it.
Right.
That's correct. And slide 31 shows the effective tax rate of the blue line being what a new field would be taxed at compared to current fields, which would be approximately 10% less at both low and high oil prices.
And then what are you using for your credit analysis and post-credits? Or I guess maybe we'll leave it for another day when we actually drill into this over multiple hearings, the incremental production issue, because I think that's what you're talking about here.
Yes.
Above the 6% decline curve.
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So we'll just save that for a future day, I guess.
And then I believe the final piece would be increased credits for infield drilling. Currently, there's a 20% credit for well-related lease expenditures. On the North Slope and 40% outside the North Slope, we would recommend extending the credit to include the North Slope to make infield development work more attractive to companies. It would improve the economics of getting more oil out of the ground as well as developing new North Slope fields.
We have been cautioned by our consultants that we have excessive credits in the state of Alaska, that we should not be continually adding on more credits. So this might be another area where we just all end up agreeing to disagree.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, yes, and it's also something that companies, when they have an opportunity, can weigh in on what it would mean to them.
I'm sure if we offer somebody a 40% credit or a 40% return on their capital cost up front, we'd have very few people that said don't send the check.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't mean whether they would like it or not like it. I mean more what are some of the things that could be done if the economics looked a little bit better.
Right.
And this is effective production tax rate with that, which is in graphing it very little difference between current law and SB 192. And in summary, this slide 34 shows effective production tax rates with all of the changes, both in SB 192 and as we've discussed. The black line is current law ACEs at different percentage tax rates as well as oil prices. The red is the current bill, SB 192. The blue would be recommended changes we've discussed for unitized fields, with the new fields being 10% below that in the dotted blue line.
And then could you run the slide again with non-unitized fields so we can kind of get an idea of the entire, because I think there's a chunk missing out of here. We've got everybody included in the black line, everybody included in the red line, unitized fields, which is the big three, in the solid blue line, incremental production in the dashed line, but we don't have in the solid blue line, we don't have the all-inclusive of everybody up there. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, when you're looking at this chart, the ACEs, the CSSB 192, and the recommended changes for unitized fields are all based on the companies that are paying tax and have a tax liability currently. The dotted blue line for the new fields is more of a hypothetical, because that would be the hypothetical tax structure that would be in place for new fields that would be outside of existing units.
Let's delete then in this next line, the composition of the next line I'm going to ask you to run, delete the dash line because it's hypothetical, and give me a line of everybody in it under the or would that be the then that would be the red line? That would be the red line includes everybody, is that correct? Unitized and non-unitized?
Mr. Chairman, currently in our forecast, we do not have any tax liability being incurred from fields that would qualify under the non-unitized for at least the next decade.
Right, but it affects our overall tax rate if you look at it, because they're swinging almost $400 million against the Treasury. It's pulling our tax rates down by roughly 5% is what I'd guess. So we can't ignore them, or we're not going to count our cash flow right.
Mr. Chairman, I think we can discuss internally how to present this, but I think the important part is this is from the producer's or the taxpayer's perspective.
Right. I understand that, but I understand it's from the taxpayer's, the guys that are paying the tax, the Big Three's perspective. This is kind of an additional issue. I'm interested to see what this would look like when we put everybody in it.
Right.
What is the overall impact to the state?
And that, I think, instead of changing this slide, I think we can show an additional slide because, you know, again, the effect on a non-producing non-taxpayer is irrelevant to a taxpayer, and that's what this is, purely for the taxpayers. So I think it's an additional slide that we would probably present to show it in a different format, to include everybody and address it more towards the government's perspective as opposed to the taxpayers' perspective.
Right. Yeah, I think we're in agreement there of why the non-unitized ones are left out, but again, I don't want to get the committee so focused on the unitized fields, we lose track of what the overall impact of the state is with everybody in the pot. Because at the end of the day, we got to drink the soup, whatever we make. And even though we're going to concentrate most of the conversation on the unitized fields, we still got to make sure we're looking over our shoulder at what we're cooking. Senator Hoffman.
I have a question on slide 35.
Sure. Slide 35. All right. We're done today.
Mr. Chairman.
He has a question.
The, Peter Van Meers has stated that the majors in North Slope are harvesting in a harvest mode, and everyone understands that outer continental shelf, it's been stated that there's probably more oil out there than in Prudhoe Bay, and Shell is drilling there, and I'm wondering if there were to be a major find in the next 4 or 5 years, very substantial to Prudhoe Bay, would the administration still be supporting this legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the administration would be, because this is specifically focused on what the state can do something about, which is state land. If Shell were to hit a major find on OCS, that's federal. It's not, we don't get any royalties off of it. We don't tax it because it's outside the state of Alaska. So the benefit to the state of Alaska would be fairly minimal. It would be reducing the tariff going through TAPS and a little bit more than that. But with the exception of the bill currently in Congress that would allow the state of Alaska to share on the OCS development similar to Gulf of Mexico states, it still wouldn't be developing the state of Alaska's land to the degree we think it could be.
Okay. But from an investor standpoint, the tax structure on the Outer Continental Shelf is vastly lower than what we have in the state of Alaska, and you've argued many times that the structure in in the Gulf of Mexico is much superior, so that's where the investment dollars are going to be going. And I would argue that that would be the same same case for Alaska if major finds were found on the Outer Continental Shelf. What advantage would investors have to invest in Alaska under that tax structure versus the vast reserves that are out there that people are saying on the Outer Continental Shelf? The dollars would not flow to onshore as a result of this. The dollars, I would assume, would be invested offshore of Alaska.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, you're correct that it would be more beneficial, and if a company was looking at a lease that in the Outer Continental Shelf that could produce at the same cost as a lease on state land, that would be of more benefit. But it gets a little bit more complicated than that because we're talking about perspectives. We're talking about out offshore as opposed to onshore, and a lot of other issues. DNR is a lot better. Be able to discuss in a lot better detail than I can, but I appreciate your point, Senator.
Well, the perspective is, if there were a major find offshore, would the administration be before us today asking for this bill? That's the big perspective, and it's there were a major find.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the answer is still yes, because we still believe there's opportunities on state land that would be taken advantage of if we were more. If the investment climate was better, not as good as federal land that's not having to deal with the state of Alaska or any other state, but in comparison to other jurisdictions.
Senator Thomas, is a question that we're running out of time?
I know we're running out of time, so this is real short and probably ask for them to bring it back. I'm intrigued by slide 9, one that shows the major producers' increase of 200,000 barrels a day, and I wonder if you could provide some information from the projects that you saw on the list at some point in time, potentially that you've talked about, how those, which projects those are that would actually cause this to happen. I realize this is theoretical, but but you're coming up with a 9.1 million anyhow. I'm not sure if that's an accurate number, why it's such a small number anyhow. So I wanted to see, especially with those number of barrels, and if that's a gross number of barrels, a net number of barrels, that's an increase over the existing number, taking into the decline, which means about actually 300 and some thousand barrels.
I think what we're going to
curious about those wells.
Right. I think we're going to spend probably a couple of days on this slide, looking at the incremental production.
Yeah.
And there is this additional $5 billion that's been talked about. So we're going to bring that up, and if you could wait on that.
I can wait. And the other thing, and I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, you're looking at it in the dollars, because I'm curious as why we're not trying to figure out some way, rather than making our split and adding incremental profit share to the federal government, why we wouldn't still be trying to split that money between the state and the industry, making use of it in-house, so to speak, rather than some of these charts show that we're increasing 5% over a period of time as we flow into HB 110. So,
okay.
And I'll have some others, but anyhow, that's it, yes.
Okay, and if the commissioner then, I'll thank the commissioner and his trustee aides for coming in today, first of many, many hearings. And if you can get back as soon as, you know, reasonably possible on those, the questions we have, so we can keep things moving along. We're going to adjourn here now. We'll reconvene at 1 o'clock, continue to work on the capital budget. We're adjourned.